So we've now come to the Lifetime Achievement Award, and I would like to invite Professor Ami Klin to come up and to introduce our recipient of the 2010 Lifetime Achievement Award. Dr. Klin, as most of you know, is at the Yale Child Studies Center. Ami, please join us.
So flashes, this is the important moment. I'm Ami Klin, and I direct the autism program at the Yale Child Studies Center. And it's indeed an honor to introduce Dr. Edward Ritva, this year's recipient of INSAR's Life Achievement Award. I'll be brief, because Ed's contributions to our field are so pervasive and multifaceted that they really defy any simple list. Personally, I was just telling him a moment ago that some of his work in the 60s and 70s were really catalysts of my own involvement and the involvement of a more than one generation of investigators and clinicians in this field. His electrophysiologic studies of sleep and hearing, studies of perception, serotonin metabolism, and his focus on the genetic contributions to autism, among so many other areas, are extremely well known. But his work as a teacher, mentor, and relentless advocate really changed the field of child psychiatry, changed laws that impact on children and families, changed the National Institutes of Health patterns of funding, and really collectively created the supreme model of the clinician, scientist, teacher, and advocate that all of us aspire to approximate. Again, personally, Ed facilitated the career of a beloved mentor, Donald Cohen, the former director of the Child Studies Center. So, in Donald's words, Ed Ritva is the unheralded visionary of contemporary research in the field of autism and child adolescent psychiatry. Well, unheralded no more. Dr. Edward Ross Ritva.
Well, I'm really overwhelmed, and those of you who know me know that that's pretty hard to happen. I want to thank Ami for that wonderful introduction and his kind words. They're especially important coming from Ami because he represents this young generation, the brilliant young researchers who are taking over from the old dinosaurs like me. And speaking of dinosaurs, I'm going to be 80 years old next week. And no, don't clap. No, don't clap. My instructions always to my students are come early, stay awake, laugh at my jokes, and don't clap at the end, throw money. But anyway, as an old dinosaur, I expect you all to respect your elders. And without further ado, we'll go on to the talk. Now, I want to begin by thanking and congratulating all of those honorees who just received their awards. And I also more specifically want to congratulate all of you who are in IMFAR and who are supporting IMFAR. In my opinion, this is by far the single one most important scientific organization that I have belonged to in my career. It was founded with one purpose in mind, namely to disseminate scientific information of the highest standards, and it's maintained this focus on this goal like a laser beam. That's why you've grown from tens to hundreds to literally almost 2,000 members now. And all of you today here, you're the scientists who are providing the evidence for the practice of evidence-based medicine that's the goal of our work and our profession. I also specifically want to mention David Amaral, your president, Simon Baron Cohen, your vice president, and the board of directors. I know they're going to stay the course, and InFAR will continue to grow and have many more thousands of members as time goes by. Now, when David first asked me to give this talk, he suggested to you that I might be, he suggested to me that you might be interested in hearing how my research career evolved over the decades. So my first thought was, well, I'll just read my CV, you know, that'll be pretty simple. But then I knew that would put you all to sleep in 5 minutes. So rather, I decided to tell you how I figured out which signposts to read and which paths to follow along for my 40 years, my 50 years now, of journeying along the research trail. And I'll mention a few ways how we went on that and some of the bumps on the road. So bear with me. I promise you this afternoon, no hard data, no PowerPoints, no Veramax rotations, no ANCOVAs, no cannellonis, just the recipes that we followed and some of the meatballs we found. Before we start down the trail, though, I want to tell you a very personal story. And then I'll tell you how it relates to each and every one of you sitting here. It was 1959, and I was in the Army, and I just arrived home on leave one evening to find my father sitting in his study writing. He was the chairman of the X-ray department of Boston City Hospital and a professor at Harvard, Tufts, and BU Medical School. "What are you working on?" I asked. "I'm starting a series of books to diagnose different parts of the body." "What part did you start on?" "Well, the skull." "The skull," I said, incredulously, "that's the hardest part of the body. It has the fewest landmarks. It's the most difficult. Why on earth did you pick that one to start with?" At that, he looked up at me and he said in his kind, sort of gentle voice, "That's exactly why." At the time, I didn't realize the wisdom of his remarks, but let me tell you this. If there is a gene that codes for the curiosity, codes for wanting to find out something new, codes for wanting us to find out something no one else has ever known, then he had it, he passed it on to me. And if I had a gene chip and I could survey every member of InFAR here this afternoon, or every member in general, I would find the same curiosity gene in each and every one of you and express to a maximum degree, because that's why you're here. That's why you chose to tackle the mysteries of autism rather than a professional life devoted to dispensing services others have already discovered or invented. Now back to the beginning of our research trail. The year was 1960. I'm in my final year of child psychiatry fellowship at the Rice Davis Clinic in LA, and well on my way to my next bar mitzvah. That was to become a psychoanalyst. Psychiatry in those days could be summed up in two words, Sigmund Freud. Serendipity strikes. I got a call from Henry Work, who was the head of the child psychiatry at UCLA. Someone had to go in the Army early. Thank you. And he wanted to know if I could come for a couple of months to take over the inpatient child unit. Now, I had never had any experience with inpatient children in my training, so I jumped at it. And that few months stretched into 50 years and still counting. At UCLA, only a few days after I started, I met Ed Ornitz, a fellow child psychiatrist who had trained at a small New England university. I think it was Yale. And he was 1 year ahead of me in training. He was into skiing, mountaineering, and a lot of other things that I was interested in. He had a wonderful young family, and we soon became very good friends. As friends do, we confided in each other all of our secrets. And one of the secrets we shared was that we thought all of our professors who were talking about the psychological trauma were full of, what should I say, it's a nice audience, but you know what I'm trying to say. They were all full of BS. And the little kids that we were seeing were probably suffering from some kind of mysterious brain pathology, not psychic trauma. We conspired to set out to prove this. Our first step was to forget everything that we had been taught. Since we had no funds, no special equipment other than our eyes and our ears, we decided just to look at some of the little kids over long periods of time to see if we could see something new. In those days, the NPI was run as a state hospital, and if I wrote R on a chart, that wasn't for RITVO, that was for research, the kid could stay there as long as we wanted. $6 a day paid for the room, the nursing care, the medications, food, the whole kit and caboodle. And the state paid $6, so the families didn't have to pay anything. We set out to observe the kids for hours each day, alone, with a nurse they knew, with one they didn't know, with their parents. Now, this sounds simple, but this was not without incidents. For instance, one day I was in the basement of the hospital, and I was looking for some old records, and I came across a snooperscope from World War II. It's one of these things, this big, long thing, looks like a gun and has an infrared projector, and you had goggles to wear. Seeing that made me think, well, what would happen, what do these kids do in the dark? Maybe we should observe them in the dark. So I brought up the stuff that night and plugged in the stroboscope. We turned out the lights. I pulled the trigger, boom, boom, electricity started flying around. It was lightning bolts going through the room. And I screamed, Ed screamed, the nurse screamed. We turned on the lights, and guess what? The little kid was sitting there, calm as a clam, hadn't noticed anything. And what we realized that his fight-flight system was turned off, that something had happened in him so that he was not responsive. Now, to go back to the general picture, what we learned from these long-term observations was vital. First, there was great consistency to what the kids did over long periods of time, be it hand flapping, vocalizing, twirling, whatever it was, over a long period of time, they did the same amount per week in the morning or in the afternoon. Situational and environmental factors had nothing to do with it and had no influence on the amount of their behaviors. Secondly, we observed spurts and plateaus of development right before our eyes, and we documented alterations in responsiveness from, like, this kid who wasn't responding to the kid who was oversensitive to the slightest noises. And those changes would take place in the same kid within a matter of minutes or hours or days. We looked for, but we couldn't find any predictors for the spurts of development or the rapid changes in sensory responses. Both of these were obviously evidences of developmental problems, not psychological trauma, as we had been taught. So that was our first home run for the pathological model. These observations about the natural history of autism led us to recommend years later, in the 1970s, to the DSM-IV committee that autism should be defined by the presence of delays, plateaus, and spurts of development, and the over and under responsiveness that we saw. Needless to say, we lost out, and autism became defined by the Chinese menu system that we're all familiar with, you know, so many symptoms in column A, so many symptoms in column B. And if the kid's lucky, you get a fortune cookie, and it says you'll get treatment or something. That was a joke, by the way. Anyway, the DSM-IV committee didn't choose our, did we? We lost out to that one, but we're good losers. Now, one could not observe these children hand flapping without wondering, is this autoerotic? Are they self-stimulating, as we had been taught? Or was it evidence of an organic problem, like, say, in Parkinson's disease, where the rhythmic movement represents a release phenomena in the central nervous system? In order to test this out, I decided to take movies of a bunch of kids spinning and flapping their hands and measuring the rate and consistency of their flapping. Now, if you've ever been to a bad movie, let me tell you, watching a kid's hand go up and down in slow motion and stopping it with a stopwatch, that's a real bad movie. Anyway, sure enough, they all flapped at the same rate. And they started off flapping at the same rate and cruised along at that rate. There was no ups and downs and waxing and waning. I got some colleagues in New York to film flapping in New York and elsewhere, and surprise, surprise, they all flapped the same constant rate. More good news for the organic camp. Also, I wondered how these kids could spin around and not get dizzy, another common symptom. This led to finding an old Baronet chair, cleaning it up, and measuring the PRN, post-rotatory nystagmus. This proved to be markedly shortened when we measured the kids in the light, with inputs from both their eyes and their vestibular system. But when we measured the PRN with the children blindfolded, there was no difference between the autistics and the normals. This told us that their brains could process one input normally, but two inputs, visual and vestibular, they couldn't handle or process in a normal way. Another home run for the organic crowd. About this time, we got to wanting to study the EEG of our autistic kids, as there was a growing interest and a concern in the relationship between epilepsy and autism. To do this, we sought the advice of Dr. Walters, the head of the neurology department. While we found no difference between the EEGs, the clinical EEGs, between the autistics and the age match comparisons, Ed Ornitz became very enamored by the new discovery to REM sleep. Now, this led us to watching a bunch of the autistic kids and the normal kids sleep in the lab and staging their sleep cycles. Interestingly, we found that the maturational changes in sleep stages appeared at a slower rate in some of the autistic kids, indicating a maturational delay. Wanting to follow up on this, we learned that the same lab was conducting studies on the auditory evoked potential, the AER. This is a signal in the AEG, in the EEG produced in response to a clicking sound. So now we're watching kids sleep all night and playing loud clicks over their head through a loudspeaker. That was really torture to the in the name of science for us. Again, we found that while in the normal kids, there's an inhibition, a normal inhibition of what we call the N2 wave as they grew older. In some of the autistic children, this did not appear. There was a persistence of the infantile pattern, another maturational delay, and another win for the organic camp. While this is going on, I was wondering naturally enough, what does the brain of an autistic child look like? There was only one report at the time of one autopsy in the literature, and at that time, it seemed like a good path to follow. When I said path to follow, that's a pun. Autopsy study, it's late in the day. Okay, that's a path study. Come on, guys. Oh, my. It's too late in the day. You should have, David, why don't you schedule me at 9 o'clock next time? Okay. This is heavy stuff, come on. Anyway, we're now in the ghoulish business. I was the chairman at that time of the professional advisory panel of the Autism Society, so I got to go around the country giving lectures a lot to parents groups. And I began inserting a little commercial, you know, if your child dies or if you know a child who died. And eventually, after so many painful phone calls, as you can imagine, we eventually got four brains to study. With the help of Dr. Scheibel, the director of the UCLA Brain Research Institute, a world-class neuropathologist, I published our findings, a significant decrease in the Purkinje cells. This was the first prospective autopsy study in autism. Now, just after this was published, I received a phone call from Boston from a young girl who was just finishing her training. She was interested in neuropathology of autism, and could I meet with her and a colleague? They came to LA and we met for a pizza lunch. Now, this young girl really impressed me. She was knowledgeable and enthusiastic. She was all excited about a new method to look at the brains, and to make a long story short, by the time I got halfway through the pizza, I made a decision. I told her I could never conduct the extensive studies that she and her colleagues were planning, so what if I gave her all of our brains to jumpstart her work and left the neuropathology business to her? She jumped at the chance. I sent the brains to Boston, and I'm glad to report that she was a winner. Do you know who I'm talking about? The first name Margaret mean anything to you? Yeah, that's Margaret Bauman and Jack Kemper. They have made many seminal contributions to our field since then, so she proved her enthusiasm and her dedication has proven out. Now, through the 70s and the 80s, the next path to my research trail started with a sign that said, neurobiochemistry this way. I started down it one morning when I was met an old friend with a smile on his face. What makes you so happy today, I said to John. That was John Menkes, whom some of you might know from Menkes disease. He was world-class number one pediatric neurologist at the time, having discovered this disease. Also, he was a playwright and had written, why were you so happy? Well, he said, Rick Shane and Danny Freeman are coming to join the faculty and they've been studying a neurotransmitter and they've even tested it on an autistic child or two. I said, oh, that's very interesting, a neurotransmitter. Be more specific. Well, let me interrupt this for a minute. When I was in medical school, I learned that a nervous impulse went down, you know, the nerve, came to the end, jumped over, a little spark jumped over, and went down the next one. It's very simple. No, that's what we were taught. By the way, some of you are probably wondering, who was my biochemistry teacher? I'm going to tell you. Are any of you interested in science fiction? I don't mean Iron Man. I mean real high IQ science fiction. You know who my biochemistry teacher was? You're going to say, wow, Isaac Asimov. Wow. That always gets a wow. Anyway, John explained to me that these guys were interested in this whole new field of neurotransmitters, and my old story was wrong. Something came down and leaked out and went over to the next, you know, that really basic stuff. We didn't know from reuptake then. It was just something leaking out. Anyway, I should go over to the VA and talk to Ed Geller and Art Uwiler, who were two world-class neurobiochemists. Now, as I shall relate to you their work, but I want to tell you something about them. We worked for many years, from the 1970s to today. We're even consulting now. And I'll only tell you one little anecdote about them, but it tells the whole story of them and all the people I've mentioned who volunteered their time and efforts to autism in those days. And still. The story starts this way. One day, this was much later, one day after we've been closed.